This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Welcome to the spring quarter at UC Santa Barbara's Distinguished Lecture Series. Super excited to have a friend and a very distinguished executive in his own right here to share his thoughts with us tonight, Brett Kane. Brett was the former president of Citrix Online, major division of Citrix, which is a public company, which arose out of a company that started in Santa Barbara called ExpertCity.com. So Brett had that rare experience of going from a startup, real scrappy, entrepreneurial, we got to make this thing happen every day, to growing that business into the third largest software as a service company in the world, behind Salesforce.com and Oracle. That is quite an accomplishment. That's the gentleman that we have here with us tonight. He did it with a team, but he certainly led that charge. He came in, Brett came in, we were doing about $35 million in revenue. I was part of that organization. I left after we sold the company. When Brett left, the company was doing well. The division that Brett was running was doing well in excess of $500 million of recurring annual revenue. So that's a huge, huge accomplishment. Again, a huge SaaS, software as a service business. Brett has had an impeccable track record of picking teams, and I think that's something you guys can certainly learn from him tonight. How do you find a team that's a winner? How do you find opportunities that will work for you? In addition to Citrix, he was at Software.com, which was another local success story here in Santa Barbara. Went public, had a very nice exit, and he was with a number of other companies in his career, including Clarify. Let's give Brett a very warm welcome.
Well, thank you very much. You know, for a long time, as John just described, the people that I would present to worked for me, and they were never as enthusiastic as all of you. So I'm really, really pleased to be here. I've been on a sabbatical for about 8 months. I left Citrix in the summer, and have really been enjoying some downtime after 10 years. I met John over 10 years ago, and so we had this amazing run building the team from, you know, $40 million, as John described, to, you know, this year, well in excess of $600 million. A really phenomenal run and something I'm especially proud of in my career. And when John invited me to come speak, I thought about, well, what kind of things could I impart on you? Because, like all of you, I started back in my university career. I went to NYU, New York University, in New York City, in the heart of New York City. My campus was the city, and that was both great and challenging because meeting people in the city of New York, if you've ever been there, it's pretty daunting. We had a terrific culture at NYU. I was in the School of Business, went to the School of Business because I was biz ed, and being in the business world really mattered to me in my life. I knew early on that I wanted to be in companies, I wanted to lead companies if possible, and I wanted to have a big impact on helping companies and customers really lead better lives. It sounds kind of hokey when you think about it in your early 20s, but I was interested in companies that were doing things like office automation and really trying to change the way people worked, you know, way back then. I graduated in 1981 with a BS in marketing. I had you know, very good grades, probably not as good as all of you, because to get into UCSB is a very, very high bar and something you should all be very proud of. So I came out of school with a ton of student debt because I didn't have a lot of money. So I had to borrow money. I got scholarships and grants. So I had a ton of debt. I had no money. I had to work through my entire college career. I worked on weekends. I worked early in the morning. I worked at the NYU Law School running the interview center. So I'd get there at like 6:30 in the morning. I have to make the coffee for the attorneys from big law firms around the world that were coming on site to interview law students that were graduating from the law school. And so I had to, you know, dress, I had to make coffee, I had to be awake and greet, you know, very well-established attorneys that were coming in to interview the law students at NYU. And I wasn't a law student and I wasn't going to be a lawyer, so you can imagine how much fun that was. And then, so I left. I got a job. In fact, I asked the company if I could start working before I graduated. That's how really how broke I was. And they said yes. So I was able to go in, based on my course schedule, I was able to go in a couple of days a week and really start learning. I took a sales position in a computer company, and I started to learn really on the job. Before the formal training program started, before I was, ultimately I flew to Texas for 3 weeks to learn all about computer systems and how to sell and talk to customers and all the things you had to do back in the early 80s in order to really sell complex computer information systems. In my case, I was selling on Wall Street to banks and financial institutions. So I got my start. I was really happy when I got my first paycheck because it was more money than I ever made in my life combined. Like everything I had ever done before that, my first paycheck was more than all that combined. So I felt really, really good about that. And then I started, right? I went to this three-week training program. I came out of that learning a bunch about things that I really didn't necessarily understand. But I had to get on the phone and really just try and speak to chief information officers, vice presidents of management information systems, really kind of daunting titles, people with a lot more technical experience and knowledge than I had, and really just try to get an entrance and try to get into a conversation with them. You know, learn about who they were, learn about what mattered to them, and try to engage them in a way that they would at least give us a few minutes of their time. And I did that, you know, pretty successfully and subsequently went on to work in a number of other companies like that. And really what I learned from that experience is, you know, there's only so much training you can get. There's only so much schooling you can use. And then at some point, what you really have to do is you have to start applying what you've been told in a way that you can internalize it for yourself and really apply it in a way that feels like it's part of you, like it becomes part of you in a way that you never thought was possible. And it happens from trial and error, from, in the case of a salesperson, picking up that phone, even though you're nervous and you're not really quite sure what you're going to say if the person really answers the phone, right, to actually getting somebody live on the phone, and then what do you do? And then how do you start? And what do you say? And how do you engage them? And every time it didn't work, I'd stop, I'd make some notes, how I might do it better the next time, you know, try again. And I really think, you know, my career is really a series of learning from the experience and trying to do it better the next time. And that's everything from learning to sell, listen to customers, engage with their problem sets and what mattered to them, and improve myself. Because if I was the best I could be at that given moment, then I had a better opportunity the next time to succeed. And in my case, succeeding really mattered. It was at the core of who I was and what mattered to me. And so as you think about embarking on your careers, think about what really matters to you. Is it financial success? Is it notoriety? Is it personal aspirations, things that you know you've done a job well? The things, you know, to make your friends and family proud. It doesn't necessarily have to be fame and fortune. It could be those things. But think about what really matters to you and write that down somewhere. And you don't have to tell anybody else what it is, but write it down somewhere where you know where it is. And you can look at it and ask yourself, every day, am I getting closer or further away from that goal? Am I getting closer or further away from that goal? And you're going to have moments where you fall back, right? You're going to have moments where you fall back and you say, gee, that didn't go so well. And, you know, I've learned in my time that there are good days and growing days. And I can tell you, you never learn anything on a good day. Just doesn't happen. On a growing day, huge. And that's true in life, personal, career, business, everything about life. When you grow, you learn, you get better, and you can apply that experience. So I went through these series of experiences of selling, and I changed a few companies. I had an opportunity to go move to London when I was about 30. And I went to London sight unseen. I traveled through Asia when I was in my kind of mid-20s for 3 weeks with a friend of mine who was in the import-export business. I was able to tag along with him and travel throughout Asia. It was a fascinating experience. I gained a lot of perspective on cultures and doing business. He was actually working, and I went to work with him on vacation. That's how much I wanted to learn about things that were happening around the world. It was crazy. I spent 3 weeks traveling all over the world with him so I could learn how people did business in Asia. And that was my vacation, because I wanted to get better. I wanted to learn something because I knew at some point I was going to do business on my own, or I was going to run a global company or do something. And I thought, at some point, this information is going to be helpful to me. So I went sight unseen. I'd never been to London. I moved to London to take an assignment with two other colleagues, where we went in and we had to really restart a business that was already established for our company. And we had to go in and we had to reset the business. We had to, instead of selling to customers directly, we had to learn how to sell through a partner. In this case, the partner was IBM. So we were a pretty small company. We were maybe 500 people. And, you know, IBM, right? And IBM was as big then as they are now, right? Huge. And so our challenge was to try to get their attention, to get them to be interested in talking with us so we could help their customers, ultimately our customers, be successful. And that was a really, really challenging thing to do. So I had never been to London, right? I had never sold in the UK. I had never worked in Europe. And now I was faced with this new set of challenges, not only personally and professionally, but culturally. There were sayings and expressions, and the way you just, you know, you read, the way you talked about the phone numbers, 00331177. What the heck is that? Right? That's the way the phone numbers called out, right? It's not 33444777 the way we would do it. That's the way, and all of a sudden you had to incorporate this way of speaking. It was hard. It was different. It was new. It was exciting, but it was different, and it was new. And that excited me, and it was something, again, I was interested in this idea of global business and learning more. I was very successful there. I'm, you know, obviously proud to say, but I was successful not because I was so great, but because I was able to establish some relationships with some IBM salespeople who were really awesome, and they helped us succeed. And because they succeeded, we succeeded. And it was really the first lesson I think I had about enabling others for your success and asking other people to help you so you can succeed. And I think a really important thing in your life is to figure out how to ask for help before you're in trouble. And that's really hard to do, especially when you're young. It's hard to ask for help because you have a lot of kind of personal anxiety that you think you're supposed to know all this stuff, or you think you should be smarter than you feel at the moment. And I can tell you that not everybody in the world knows everything about everything. This is not possible. And the few people that really know that much, they're on their own and you know, probably not available to help us anyway. So the notion that you can be successful by having other people succeed is a really important and powerful premise. And I personally believe that my success is predicated entirely on the people that are around me and supported me. And that's everybody from my wife and my kids to the people that John mentioned, the team that we have had and had that we built over time. Without the team, there's no way, no matter, you know, the brilliant strategy and all the things that I might be able to talk about and encourage wouldn't happen without everybody, you know, pulling in the same direction and all of us getting there together. And if figuring out in your life, in your career, how do you enable others to help propel you forward, asking for help, asking for their time, bouncing your ideas off of them and getting their feedback, and then listening to that feedback, writing it down, improving yourself, and going back to them and saying, this is what I think I heard you say. Is that right? Don't just assume you heard it the first time. Write it down, internalize it, and go back and ask them again. Is this what you meant? And they'll say, no, yes, that's good, and here's a better way to think about it. And really evolve that as part of who you are. Evolve it as your persona so people know you're going to ask questions. Asking questions is one of the most powerful things you can do in life. Because number one, it shows people you're interested, right? You're interested in them and who they are and what they're about. And number two, you learn something. Whenever you ask a question, you learn something. Right? And so you have this amazing opportunity. You're part of a huge network, being part of the university. So right there, you have an advantage, huge advantage, just simply because you have something in common with thousands, tens of thousands, really probably millions of people when you think about all the alumni over the last, you know, how long the university has been established. So this is a tremendous advantage right there. And I assure you that any alumni from this university, if you were respectful and reached them and called them and said that you're from this university and you want to ask them a question, you have just a couple of minutes of their time, I guarantee they will give it to you because you have something in common already. And so those are the things that you can glean and learn. If you can learn those early, there's really nothing that can stop you. There's nothing that can stop you except yourself. If you stop yourself, you're done. Stop yourself, you're done. Because you're really the only thing standing in front of whatever your goal and dreams are. Because you have to take that step. You have to stand in front of that person. You have to pick up the phone. You have to write the code. Whatever it is, whatever your passion is, it doesn't really matter. But you have to take that little baby step. And I really believe this notion, and it took me a long time to learn this, this idea of crawl, walk, run. So if you have little brothers or sisters or cousins or nieces or whatever it happens to be, you watch a baby grow up, and they go from this crawl, kind of wobbly walk, then they run. And it's amazing, right? You can't believe that anything could do this when they were completely dependent on you. But that's the way you establish your skills and your abilities and your skills over time, is you figure out how to crawl, how do you do very tiny little movements towards your goal. And then you kind of get up and you get a little stability and then you figure out how to walk. And then once you figure out walking, well, then you can go faster and you can run. And if you think about your challenges in those baby steps, you can conquer them because you just take on those tiny little steps each time and then you get velocity. When you get velocity, there's really nothing that will stop you. And really my career continued like that with new and different challenges, different companies, startups, small Silicon Valley startups. I did some restarts that weren't so good. Restarts are technologies that didn't find a good place, and then you have a different solution for that technology, and we try to repurpose it for something else, and that was a really bad idea because it was a bad idea to begin with, and trying to do it a second time was a worse idea. And then I was really fortunate to get a call to come to Santa Barbara, join software.com, part of a great team, same team that founded Sonos, for those of you that are local aficionados of music. The Sonos team was the same team that founded software.com. And when I left there, and I was very fortunate to join the Expert City team, and John shared with you that really astounding success, which has been not only just a great UCSB and Santa Barbara success story, but really has impacted millions and millions of people around the world. Because we've made it possible for the first time for people anywhere to have an online video conference with literally thousands of people from their home, from an office, from an airport, from literally anywhere in the world. Very high quality experience. Not a Skype experience, right? Skype's fine if you're talking to your aunt, your mom, your brother, your sister, but it's really not built for business. I'm talking about a really robust business level experience that you feel confident having with a CEO of a company, of a major company. That's the kind of experience you need to deliver in business. And that's what we were able to deliver and something I'm really proud of. So with that, I think we'll come over to questions.
Seat.
How's
right.
that?
Thanks, Brett.
Well, that was a great overview. I love that you instructed the students to define success now. Because if you go back and you know, you're 45 years old, it's a little too late.
I'm 54.
I know, you 34. He said 34, in case you guys didn't hear. But it's true. A lot of folks end up never really taking the time to do that. I sit down with entrepreneurs all the time that are looking for funding, and I'll say to them, forget about all your numbers and everything. Stop. How do you define success? And it's often very interesting, their different definitions. And all of them are valid. as long as it's truly what they're not just telling me what they think I want to hear, but it's true. I mean, for me, it was always I wanted independence. I wanted to be able to. The money was nice, but wasn't the most important thing. You know me.
Yeah.
It was more of I don't want an alarm clock driving my life. Right. I want to have. If I want to do something or if I want to travel, I want to do something. I'm going to go do it, and I want that flexibility.
Right.
And that comes at a cost.
Yeah.
It certainly comes at a financial cost, and. But it's worth it to me. So I think you guys need to sit down and decide if it's fame and fortune, go for it. If it's money, go for it. If it's just flexibility in your life and autonomy, go for it. But make sure you understand what it is or it's going to be pretty darn hard for you to get it.
Yeah.
So I'm glad you mentioned that. So talking about your career and I'm just curious, this is a bit of an esoteric question, but if you could go back and have one do-over, just one, oh, I wish I hadn't said that, I wish I hadn't done that, or I wish I had said that, I wish I had done that, is there one in your career that you would love to have back?
You know, I mentioned this this one a second ago. I went to this restart, and it really didn't start with the restart. It started when I got back from London, the story I was telling you. So I came back from London, and I had a very successful time there. It was great. The team wanted me to stay, and I just was ready to go home. I felt like I had accomplished what I went there to accomplish, right? I wanted experience. I wanted to learn. I wanted to be able to do business, you know, in another culture, in another world. I was very successful. I was the number one salesperson in the entire company. It was great. And I came back. And then the company subsequently was acquired. And there really wasn't a place, there wasn't a great role for me to, I had just done this. And I was now with the company for 5 years. And I was sort of really in search of something more. I really felt like, okay, I can do more, you know. And so the notion of going to more of a startup environment. And I joined through a colleague, through the CFO of my prior company, became CFO of this very high-profile startup in Silicon Valley. And I went there, and I missed the culture. I missed that it was a culture that really wasn't aligned with my values or the way I liked to work with people. And it was a very aggressive culture. I had just come from a culture that was phenomenal, amazing. Everybody loved working with each other. Everybody respected each other. Everybody worked together for a common goal. And then I ended up in this culture where everybody was just out for themselves, really. And it was just brutal. And I was just really unhappy. And what happened was that company subsequently got acquired within about 7 months of joining. They were acquired by Sybase, which you may or may not know, but Sybase was the big challenger to Oracle. So back in the early 90s, there was Oracle and there was Sybase. There was a couple others, but those were the two big database companies. And because you know who Oracle is, you know who won. Okay. but Sybase still exists and was a very successful company, very, very successful, especially in the 90s. And the way that integration went, there really wasn't a great place for me. So I decided to leave. And I went and I kind of ran from where I was and I ran to the next, what sounded like the next good idea. And my mistake was I went back to work with the people that were in that company that I really liked and respected. They had gone to a restart. And it was just a failed business that some really good people were trying to resurrect. And because I liked working with them so much, I made the mistake of really not understanding what the technology did, what problem we were trying to solve, what I was going to have to do as a salesperson to actually help the company be successful and be successful in myself. It's like another year. So I felt like the combination of that, I lost a couple of years. I learned a lot. It was a lot of growing days. I learned a ton. But it just wasn't great. And there were so many other exciting things happening in the Valley at the time. I was living up in Silicon Valley that I didn't need to do that.
Right.
And I think I stopped myself, okay? I stopped myself from reaching out to other people and finding other things that might have been more challenging. I went with more of the safe route.
Right.
And it was a huge mistake.
Right. No, I'm not surprised.
The one good thing, so I always think there's something good that comes from everything. The one great thing that came from that entire experience is I met my longtime friend and mentor at Sybase.
Oh, nice.
And yeah, the way it was structured, it really doesn't matter, but a peer of mine and the company I was in was assigned to that guy, and I wasn't. And I met him like 3 years later. He said, I really wish I would have gotten you because that other person was a disaster. And he and I have been friends for 20 years.
That's awesome.
So all that, despite it being a terrible career experience, was an amazing growth experience and friendship.
Right. Well, that's a great learning right there. And something else the students and anyone watching can take away is when Brett said in his opening remarks, you know, don't be afraid to ask people questions. Don't be afraid to ask someone to be your mentor, or don't be afraid to ask someone for help earlier in your career. You'll be surprised how flattered most people will be and how much benefit you'll get out of having a mentor. I'm a huge fan of mentors. It's funny, Brett's never heard me say this. So I have a recurring dream that I go back to Citrix, not every night, but and it never works out well. That's why I said I'm not surprised, because it's that feeling of like, yay, I'm going back. And then you go back and you're like, wait a minute, it's not the same.
Yeah.
And it's never the same.
It's never the same.
Yeah, so it never works.
Well,
it works in the movies, doesn't work in real life.
That's right. Everything changes. Everything moves on.
Yeah.
Relationships reestablish. Lots of things happen, but
right,
it's never
you can't
the
go
same.
Back. Yeah. No way. So I get this question a lot from students, and I thought from someone who's been an entrepreneur and also run huge companies, it might be an interesting instructive question to ask you. So students come into my office, and they don't say it often directly, but what they're really asking me is, they're saying, John, I'm trying to figure out if I'm an entrepreneur or not. Can you help me find that out? So if a student came to you and just bluntly said, Brett, how can I figure out if I'm an entrepreneur? How would you answer that question?
Right. Well, you know, I think... something came up in the previous session that I think I just want to mention is a lot of times when somebody asks you a question, they're really not asking that question. Okay, there's a question behind the question. They really can't, either emotionally or intellectually, they really can't get it out. They're either too emotional about it, like it's like really core to who they are. And if they ask it that way, they'll feel way too exposed and uncomfortable. And so part of, you know, being a great listener is to try to pull out what somebody is really trying to ask you. But in this case, I'll try to answer the question instead of
asking. I'm asking you directly. Yes. How do I know, Brett?
So I think number one is you have to fundamentally have a belief that you don't want to do anything else in life. Like that you have such a burning, burning passion that it doesn't matter what else could possibly come across your path. There isn't anything more important in your life and possibly your career than pursuing this goal, hopefully in a specified way, not just to be an entrepreneur, but to actually do something as an entrepreneur that we were talking about earlier, defines in a certain way. So I said a few minutes ago that one of the things that I'm most proud of is my work is that I've really helped change the way people work. And if you think about the beginning of my talk, what did I say? Back in the 80s, I was researching and looking at companies that were doing office automation. That was all about changing the way people worked. It just happened to be different technology, but the concepts were fundamentally the same. And so those things were fundamentally important to who I was and why I was passionate about it. Mm-hmm. So you have to figure that out for yourself, because you're going to go through a huge number of growing days as an entrepreneur. And if you're not clear on that, you're going to really wonder and wander for a long time and not either feel successful or just fundamentally not succeed without that. I think you have to have an amazing amount of persistence, because there are a lot of dark days. There are days when customers don't want to buy, or they don't want to pay, or they aren't interested in what you have. And it isn't so much that they don't think it's a good idea. It's just not in their list of priorities. Because every company, every individual has a set of priorities. And if you can get to their top priority and you can do that quickly, awesome. You're in. Easy. But the reality is that's just not the way it works usually. Right. You have to weave your way in and figure out, are you in the top 2 or 5? If you're below 5, it's not going to happen. So then you either have to go find somebody else that does have that passion and interest, or you got to figure out what you're doing that doesn't quite fit the top priorities of your target market or your target customer.
Yep.
And I think, you know, this idea of belief in yourself, and I, you know, you hear these stories about successful entrepreneurs, and you hear stories even about unsuccessful entrepreneurs, and even the ones who fail, and there's a lot of stories, especially now on blogs and on the internet, where people that have shut down their company, CEOs, founding CEOs, talk about why they shut it down and what they learned from it, and actually why it might be good. And a lot of those people go off and they start something new, right? Look, the guys that invented Twitter, reinvented Twitter because what they thought it could be wasn't working.
Yep.
Right? They didn't know this 144 character thing made any sense, but they kept at it. They kept at it.
Yep, which is typical. If you look at most stories, even Expert City, we didn't end up doing what we started doing.
Great example.
So I'm going to turn it over to you guys in a minute. Get your questions ready. The only thing I would add to that, Brett, is what I often tell students is look at your past to answer that question. Don't look at your future. Because they often want to say, well, if I take a job at a startup, does that make me an entrepreneur? Well, no, obviously it doesn't. So I often tell students, look at your past. Were you always sort of doing, did you always have three side projects on this, in high school, junior high? Were you a self-starter?
Absolutely.
Do you do everything it takes to succeed? Are you passionate about things you believe in? Blah, blah, blah. And that's really where the answer lies, not in what a professor tells you or what you read in the book.
Right.
It's what's in your heart.
Yeah.
So, cliche, the only cliche of the night. Okay, so who's got the first question for Brett? Make it a hard one. Come on, the first one's always hard. Icebreaker, here we go.
Thank you.
So, you said when you moved to London, you had the highest sales record in your company. And you must have had to adapt when you first moved there. So, I'm really curious as to whether you had a very specific sales style, which you then adapted to your environment, or did you retain your original style? And what was more successful?
Thank you. I always had a very consultative style, and meaning I was always prepared with a list of questions. I researched the companies. So we're talking about very large companies like Shell UK. So, the UK division of Shell Oil. So, multi-billion-dollar divisions, so large systems, big companies, and you just weren't going to be able to go in and talk to a general manager of a department or a division without really doing your homework. So it involved doing a lot of homework, reading the equivalent of the annual reports, the financial reports that were available at the time, talking with people that maybe knew about the company and could give you some insight and information, reading the periodicals and the press, figuring out what their strategies were, and how you thought we had a decision support analysis tool. That's what we sold. And trying to figure out how what we did could help, in the case of Shell or McVitie's, which is a big biscuit company in the UK, how we could help them improve their sales. That's what we set about doing. And so I wouldn't go in to sell them. I went in, if I got an appointment, I would go in and interview them. I would ask them a series of questions. I would first tell them about what I understood about them and their company, and then I would ask their permission if I could ask them a series of questions. And then we would go through that, and that was what the meeting was. It wasn't to present, it wasn't to talk about us or our products. We really tried to shy away from doing that to the best of our ability. And people would walk away from this going, wow, that was the weirdest sales call I was ever in. Because aren't you going to pitch me on what you have to offer? It's like, nope, we don't have enough information to tell you whether we can help you. So the notion of this is very consultative. And we would ask them, is there anybody else in the company we could talk to that might be interested in a similar kind of meeting? And so we kind of would go through the organization, finding our way, weaving our way, asking how the organization was laid out, who was in charge, who was the decision maker, what was their style, what were they like? And I was very patient. So I was willing to go through that process. And the result was we got some very large orders because we were able to then go back with all that knowledge, go in and marry up what we did well with what they said their issues were. And they were like, wow, you nailed it. Of course we want to do business with you. I think the cultural things were more of the things I had to adapt to. I had to get used to just the way business was done, the pace, the style, the jokes, the innuendos, the slang. Those are the things that just whip right by you as an American that you just don't even get for like a year, right? So the first year, your brain is still trying to catch up with the joke that everybody around you is laughing at.
Right.
And so that's just cultural. Well,
it's a totally different language.
Yeah, that's right. It's very true.
Well, so that it's interesting to hear you say that because you were selling to big companies. Yeah. And so you actually were doing what a sophisticated salesperson does, which is sort of morphing your reality to match their reality.
Right.
Instead of a lot of startup salespeople, which I am one of, like to go in and just bang out the sale, right? Come on, Brett, come on, buy
Let's
it,
go.
You know? And clearly that's not going to work. You have to establish rapport first, and you were establishing rapport while you were gathering information.
Right.
You can have the world's best information, all the answers. If you don't have rapport, nobody's going to listen to you.
That's right.
So,
yep.
Brilliant. I'm curious, we'll get ready for the next question in the audience after I ask this one. So you were, again, in that wonderful arc of startup to public, you know, division of a huge public company, very successful. Were there moments when you look back now that you say, yep, that was a turning point, or that was a watershed event where we went from scrappy to self-sustaining? I'm just curious, not having gone through it like you did, were there moments like that?
Oh, there are a lot of moments like that. I mean, we used to kind of kid ourselves that we were the teenagers. I mean, so just to kind of put it in context, when John was talking about earlier, $35 million when Citrix acquired us, 2004, a couple hundred people, and Citrix was $550 million. So over 10 times bigger than us. We were maybe 200 people, they were like 2,000 people. We had a very different business model. So we were independent. We had this sort of wholly owned business. We were kind of our own thing, and they left us alone, and all that was good. But that also created this notion that we could kind of bang our spoon on our high chair because we knew what we were doing and we were going to do it the way we committed we would do it. Like, no, you asked us to do these things, we're going to do those things, leave us alone, don't bother us. And that worked really well for a while, right? That worked really well. Mm-hmm. And as long as we delivered the results, everybody was happy,
right?
Growth was strong, profits were up, all was good. And then, you know, in time, as we got bigger, we got $100 million, then got $150 million. We were now 400 people, 500 people. You know, things got a little bit harder. And I'd say two things happened. One, we realized that the way we went about predicting the future wasn't going to work, meaning how we were going to forecast our future sales was just getting harder to do. And I also had to negotiate an annual revenue number and a profit number with the CFO of Citrix. So every year we had to kind of look ahead and say, well, what do we really believe we could do? So I had $150 million in like 2007. Mm-hmm. What do we think it looks like? Is it 250? Is it 230? Is it 210? You know, and you got to like pick a number, and then you build a plan based on that. And I think the real turning point for me was I went from, instead of trying to lowball the number, mm-hmm. to actually having a conversation with the CFO and said, let me tell you and let me help you understand what the metrics and optics of our business, let me tell you what we see, let me tell you what we believe, and based on that, let's have a conversation about what the number could be or should be. Mm-hmm. And it was really a change. It was a sea change in how we approached it. And I think it really helped us grow up. And we went from these teenagers who were kind of raiding the refrigerator to, you know, young adults who were now responsible for our future.
Well, I definitely wouldn't have done well there because I'm not responsible.
I would agree.
I would have raided the refrigerator until they kicked me out. Let's take another question. We have one over here.
Yeah, earlier you made a brief mention of a longtime friend and mentor.
Yeah.
Would you mind sharing more about maybe how you found this person or perhaps how they found you? And the impact that they've had on your life professionally and personally, or vice versa.
So how you cultivated that relationship.
Sure. It's kind of an interesting story. So so I was at this company that was acquired by the company he was with. He was a regional sales leader, so I was in sales. He ran the whole West for Sybase. Really nice guy. We both grew up in New York, in the New York area, so we kind of had a bit of a kinship just from that. We're both transplants to California. I think we both really just liked each other right out of the gate. We just kind of had that affinity. You know how it happens in life. You meet somebody and you just have an affinity for them. There's similar, you know, cultural or family backgrounds, yep. and just happens in life. And he happened to be one of those people. So I went off. I went to these other companies. And then I ended up at another startup, which was in the sales automation business. And lo and behold, he had changed companies, and they were looking to acquire a sales automation company. And so we reconnected, really, through that. The company he was with acquired the company I was with. And we actually took a trip back east to see a customer together, because I ran sales for this company, and he was running sales for the company that was acquiring us, which was Clarify.
Oh, nice.
And so we got to spend a couple of days together. And, you know, we flew back and forth to the East Coast and back to California. We spent a lot of time together, and we just got to know each other as people. And you know, he really trusted me because he now had that reflective experience of meeting me 3 years earlier and now realizing that he had wished we could have worked together. Mm-hmm. And now we had a chance to work together again. So I ended up working for him for about 3 years. And he's just that kind of guy. We had honest, straightforward relationship. He would, you go in and talk to him about a sales strategy or a customer or situation. And he was very quick to just, he'd listen really well. And then he'd say, I'll never forget it. He'll say, that doesn't make any sense. And it wasn't so much what he said, it was the way he said it. It caused you to pause and really think about what you were saying. And, you know, this idea of reflecting. And he was that kind of leader. He'd made you reflect and think about what really mattered, and the way you were approaching it made sense, and if not, what together you could do about it. And then he subsequently left. He went on. He became a CEO of a company. He took it public. He then took a little time off. Then he became a venture capitalist, he's in a VC firm. And, you know, and I've just started up my own CEO search, and he's the first person I went to go see because that's the kind of relationship we have. And he calls me all the time, and he asks me my input and my opinion because of the experience I had.
Yep.
And it's just a very collaborative relationship now.
I think that's when you know a mentor relationship is sort of reached its apex is when they start asking you for information.
Right.
So anybody that reads my blog and is kind of familiar with what's going on in my world, I wrote an entry that did pretty well. It was about you're never too old for a mentor because I ran into somebody, Brett knows the story, I told him about it. And it's just incredible that somebody at my age can still meet someone that can impart wisdom and take you down a path that you haven't gone down yet, but they've done it themselves. So you're also never too young for a mentor. You guys got to jump on that. I'm busy, but you can ask Brett. He'll be your mentor. So you mentioned that it was tough when you were forecasting as part of a public company. Those numbers have to be right.
Yeah.
I'm curious. I'm sure there's a lot of other challenges in the business, but from a management standpoint, having thousands of people, either directly or indirectly, looking to you for answers, looking for you to be the mentor. What was probably this, if you could put it in terms of the single greatest challenge in just for you personally running an organization of that size, and how did you overcome it?
Well, it changed over time. So the first big challenge I had was the day, and you were there, the day when it was announced that I was going to be the new head of Citrix Online. And we were all outside. We were not far from here. We had our offices not far from here. And we were all outside. And I was asked, basically, you know, what my idea was for the company going forward. Right? And I just wasn't ready for that. I hadn't prepared for that question.
Right.
And I said, well, you know, and I said something kind of off the cuff. And the person who asked the question was a member of the leadership team and really challenged me in front of the whole team and said, no, we're not going to let you get away with that. You know, you really need to tell us what you think. And so I kind of, you know, flood my way through.
It wasn't me, by the way.
It wasn't John.
I would never do that.
John would never do that. And I made my way through that moment. And then I really vowed to myself that I wasn't going to really let myself, I wouldn't put myself in that position again. I would always be prepared whenever I got in front of the team. And so I always had notes. I had notes in my notebook. I had notes on cards. I had the things that mattered, or I had slides. I would usually do a monthly or quarterly all-hands meeting. And the slides weren't complex, but they were really just cues for me to talk about the things that were on my mind, the things that I needed to talk about, that I thought were important for the team to hear. And a lot of times they were the same things, right? Because you establish a set of principles, guidelines, and strategies, like no more than five, and then you set measures around them, and then you remind everybody over and over again, those are them. Like, this is what it's about. And if you think it's about something else, go back and read these five things. It's that basic. And I think over time, what I really learned was to incorporate that into my style and really help the team through that because it became very complex.
Yeah.
2,000 people, you know, 8 or 9 countries, 6 acquisitions, you know, you were talking about $500 million trying to grow and be profitable, keep everybody on the same page. And it really became part of who I was. It became part of just my style that I needed to remember that not everybody knew or understood it as well as I did. And I needed to take the time to keep everybody on that same page. That was my job.
Yep. Well, you did a great job of it. And something I think we can learn from your career that all of you can learn from is, like, be the Beatles, right? The Beatles broke up at their most popular point, right? We all remember the Beatles yeah. as just incredibly popular. We don't remember them being as drug-addled 1970s has-beens, which they probably would have been. And you left on the top as well, right? Yeah. So just going out and not trying to get one more year out of it, right. one more quarter, going out on top is great advice for anybody. Let's take another question from the audience. We've got one over here mic'd up.
Earlier in the talk, we discussed the importance of a team. Can you go into some detail about the value of a team and the challenges in choosing a team?
Yeah, it's a great question. Look, I don't think anybody is successful without the team succeeding. And, you know, I think what it really comes down to people, and everyone's different. Just everyone is different. And, you know, I've been part of three or four really great teams in a career of 30-some-odd years, right? I mean, that's good.
Yep.
You know, I mean, one run was 10 years, right? So this last run was 10 years. That was great. The example, which included the London experience, that was a five-year run. That was great. So that's 20 of 30. That's pretty good. And then the Clarify one where I worked for my mentor, that was about a four-year run. So I had a pretty good hit rate, mm-hmm. right? And I feel good about that. And, you know, but what I've learned is, and it's still true even today, as I meet people on boards or potential investors or lots of things, the same thing is true. You meet somebody and you say to yourself, do I want to work with this person all the time? How would I feel if I was with this person 20 hours a day on planes, at hotels, eating terrible food, you know, you're dead tired, you've been on the road for a week. Do I want to be with this person? Is this the person I want to work with? Like, I'm going to spend more time with this person in the course of a week than I do with my wife. And if the answer is I don't think so, the answer is that person is not on my team. That is really a fundamental filter. And sometimes you don't always have that choice, right? You get thrown together on a team and then you have to work together. But if you're hiring a team or you're leading a team, you do have a choice. And part of your responsibility is to help that person who might be an outsider become more of an insider, have them bring them in, try to help them develop their skills, abilities, and how they collaborate with the team and see if they can succeed. And by helping them, giving them feedback, being honest. Say, you know what you just said to Joe? Not so good. You hurt that person's feelings, you know? I mean, you can't expect them to want to help you when you need help if you're going to call them out in the middle of the meeting and tell them that XYZ was wrong, right? I mean, it's really not what you say to somebody, it's how you say it. And I think building a team is about having a group of people that can work together, can call people out in a professional way, whatever that means in the environment, but really respect each other and want to be in that, you know, that trench together for a long time, because you're talking years of your life, you know, good 10, 12, 15 hour days, and you really want to filter based on that and make sure that those are the kind of people you want. You respect them, their integrity, their intelligence, their ability, their can-do attitude, hard work. I mean, all those things that you believe are true about yourself, you want to filter those things about the people that you're selecting.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, students are victims of Mad Men and The Office.
Right.
Work, real work is like neither of those shows, right? It's not all about the hookup.
Right.
And you actually do work, which they never seem to do in The Office. So those are quite fictionalized accounts. So you mentioned the attributes you look for, you know, the airport test of, can I sit in a red carpet room with this person? But I'm curious, because you have had a great track record of picking winning teams. When you're actually looking at the opportunities, and I think this is also informative to students that would be looking for potential jobs and looking for maybe some startups or early stage companies to join, what else do you look at besides, obviously the people are important, sure. but what else do you look at to sure. vet that opportunity?
Yeah. You know, clearly the culture matters, right? How do people feel about it? You know, hopefully you'll get to meet a wide number of people. And I think if you are invited to join a company and you don't meet more than, you know, two or three people, I would ask, is there some, are there some other people that I can meet? Are there any other early, you know, people that have recently graduated from college? I would encourage you to try to meet more people, really get a sense and try to meet with them outside of the office, maybe have lunch or a coffee with them. Yeah. Really try to get a sense of what's the culture like. You know, what time do people come in the morning? Do people go to the gym? What are people's passions? People go out together. You know, is it expected that we go out together? Really try to figure out what drives the company and the people, and are they a collective or are they a bunch of individuals just show up and do work together? Because there's a very big difference between the two. And one, you'll feel like you're part of a team or a family, if that matters. And the other, you'll feel like you're really just kind of like a drone. You're there to work your butt off, but not necessarily feel like you're part of whatever's being accomplished. And so, you know, that might be okay with you. That might be, you know, going to go learn how to do XYZ, and you, when you're done with that, you're going to leave and you're going to go do something else. But if it's important for you to feel like you're part of something that matters, then I think culture really matters. And then I think whatever it is, the third thing is whether it's the technology or the market or the environment or the solution or whatever metaphor you want to use for whatever it is matters for your career or the work you want to do. Is it something that interests you and you have a passion for? Are you interested? Because if you're not interested, there's no way you're going to be successful. Not because you can't grind it through, but you just, it's going to be miserable. It's just going to be terrible. You're going to hate it. And you got to love what you do. You just got to love what you do. So, you know, great technology is awesome. You can, nowadays, you can usually see great technology. You can at least feel it, right? Especially with the consumerization of technology, you know, running on you know, iPads and Androids. There's lots of stuff out there you can kind of get a sense for. And try to look out in the world and see what people are saying about that company or those customers. There's lots of stuff on social media about how people treat their customers. That gives you a lot of insight about how they treat their employees. And every company does not get it right every time. Okay, so there's lots of blow-ups that happen on social media today because something happens. It's unfortunate, but the truth is that most of the technology now runs in the cloud, and it doesn't operate all the time. And so people get upset because they've come to rely on it. And but you can learn so much because so much of this is now transparent.
Yep.
And it didn't used to be transparent. Now it's all transparent. So use it.
Students sitting out there saying, but Brett, I would feel really uncomfortable asking those kind of probing questions. If the culture's bad and they don't want you asking those questions, that's your answer.
That's right.
So it's awesome. I often tell students, like, go on LinkedIn and find a recent graduate and reach out to them directly.
That's right.
Have coffee, whatever, and that will empower you so much when you go in for your interview. Or if you've already had one interview and you're going in for a follow-up, you can actually say, hey, I sat down with Brad. I was really impressed by the things he told me. You will now put yourself in the 1%.
Absolutely.
Because nobody does that. So you guys need to do that. Let's take the last question from the audience. Who's got just a killer, unbelievable... and you have a microphone. Who's mic'd? Go.
Hi. So you've had extensive experience working in a startup, right here. What would you say is the most challenging thing and the most satisfying thing about it?
And before he answers, I feel terrible because there was some plaintive looks here. One more person. We'll do one more question for the audience. Sorry.
Okay. Nope. It's okay. You know, I would say the most challenging thing, especially, you know, in my case, I was in sales, right? Was when, you know, you spend a lot of time, effort, and energy and really try to help a customer, not sell a customer, help a customer. And, you learn that what you have just doesn't quite meet their needs. They actually feel bad to tell you that it's not going to work. And you just sit there and you wonder to yourself, is everybody going to feel this way? Am I going to put all this effort, am I going to put so much of myself into this, and then just to find out that the solution just isn't going to make it, right? And that, you know, that's hard because it really requires you to have a tremendous amount of intestinal fortitude, right? And I imagine, I'm trying to remember back to my own university days, I had a very difficult time with physics. And I sort of relate that experience to how difficult it was for me to get through my physics class. I just never thought I was going to get through. And if you've had that kind of experience, you just don't want that in your career. You don't want to feel that way, and you don't want to feel that way in a startup because you're believing in the dream. I think conversely, I think when a customer, you know, is successful or the company is successful, you release something that really helps people. Like we, in the case of the sales automation company I was talking about earlier, we introduced a completely new way for customers to keep track of their sales contacts and their opportunities. This is kind of what you do in sales. And customers were just blown away by it. And we hadn't even sold them anything yet. They haven't bought it. Mm-hmm. But they were so excited about it. It got us excited because it felt like everything we had worked so hard on really made a difference.
Right. Yeah. I'm smarter than Brett. I was smart enough not to take physics.
Yeah, boy, what a mistake.
I knew I would not have done well. Okay, we'll take the last one from the audience.
Hello. So I wanted to know, what is your favorite quality about yourself, and how much do you think it contributed to your success?
Favorite quality? This is good looks. Come on. I'll say it.
Thanks, John. I... I think maybe I should stop there.
All right, we'll edit that.
No, for really my whole life, literally, you know, since I was young, I always strove to be better than I was, whatever that was. And it wasn't always great at everything. I'm not necessarily a natural athlete. I'm okay and. You know, just whatever. But I always, like, I play tennis now, and I want to get better. And I take lessons, and I ask people that are better than me to play with me. And, you know, and I just, I'm very competitive, and I want to win. but really, what I want to be as good as I can be. And that's always been true. It's just, you know, always been true. And so my whole life, I worked at whatever it was, I worked at it. And I tried to get better. And I think that ultimately is what enabled my success. And I was fortunate enough that the people around me gave me the time to develop whatever that was. And I think that was true. You know, John knows the person that I worked for at Citrix for almost 10 years, Mark.
Yep.
Mark was a tremendous advocate and supporter. And it made me want to do better because he supported me. And if you can find somebody like that, you're going to be golden.
You talked about walk, crawl, walk, run.
Yeah.
The people that succeed in life, I'm convinced of this. And this one reason children learn so many things is they don't realize they're bad at things, right? They just keep going. They're like, they're oblivious. I can't draw. Look, mommy, and you put it on the refrigerator, and you love it, right?
Yeah.
When we become adults, we become very self-critical, and oftentimes we shut down a talent because we're not instantly really good at it, or we don't excel immediately at it. And I think people that are successful are willing to just fight through that.
Right.
It's that whole 10,000-hour principle that we've heard of over and over again. You're willing to put in those 10,000 hours, you will become very good at it. I almost guarantee you. Unless it's dunking from the free throw line or something. But if it's not a physical limitation, then you'll probably be able to achieve it if you put in the time. So, Brett, I know you're busier than ever, even though you're on a hiatus. You're always traveling. So I really appreciate you working this into your schedule. Let's thank Brett.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.